So there is a new sheet. So the one sheet, they both say Revelation 6, but the sheet we've been working off is on both sides, right? The new sheet is on one side. So the both sides are gone back there. There were a few at the beginning. They're now gone. The one side is still back there. So we'll just finish up verses 5 and 6 on the double-sided one, and then we'll jump over to the one-sided one. Does that make sense? Everybody? Yes? No? Maybe so? Okay. How many of you had coffee this morning? Some of you, I'm just not sure if you had coffee this morning. So we are, to be fair, in the really, I think, my favorite time of the year for Colorado. Took my dogs out for a long walk yesterday. We went for about 45 minutes. I had their tongues hanging on the ground, so that's good, because then they took a nap and they stopped bothering me for the rest of the day while I had to work. but it was chilly. The wind was a little bit blowing, but it was just so nice, and so we're blessed. We're blessed. Okay, Revelation chapter 6, the last paragraph there, we're looking at these seals being opened. Remember, the scroll is the title deed of planet Earth. The scroll is title deed of the universe, and only the Lamb slain before the foundation of the world can open the scroll. We saw it in Revelation 4 and 5. They're praising God because we're in heaven now, and the rapture's taking place, and we're in heaven, and we're with that heavenly host praising him for being creator God, Revelation 4, praising him for being redeeming God in Revelation 5. There's five great anthems of praise, which closes in Revelation 5 with everything in heaven, under heaven, above the earth, everybody singing praises to God. And then that scroll that only the Lamb slain before the foundation of the world can open, they start opening the seals. And I had explained to you the scrolls and how that was a very common form of having on the outside what was on the inside as far as the title deed. They did this with property. Like, we would buy and sell your house, and you're given a deed to your property, right? Most of you, us, the bank has that. But when we get to the final payment, you know, we get the deed. So God has the Lamb, who is the Lamb has the title deed, but Satan stole that title deed when he caused Adam and Eve to sin. And so with the book of Revelation, starting in chapter 6 to verse 19, to chapter 19, is about how the Lamb will go about getting his property back, which is you and me and the universe. And so the first seal he unwraps, and that's the Antichrist. We've already looked at that. Then after the Antichrist, the second seal is, we saw that there is another horse, and it's a red one, verse 3. And of course, the Antichrist will come as a man of peace. But by the time you get to the second half of the 3.5 years, or the 7 years, you get to that second half, he's going to be a man of war, right? Killing and conquering that way. The third seal then, as we saw in verse 5, is a black horse, and that is famine. The quart of wheat for a denarius. We talked about what those weights were. In other words, a man will go and work all day and only have enough bread for himself and nothing for his family. That's how bad the famine will be. You'll work all day, 12-hour day, and you'll get enough money to buy wheat for one person, for one day. So you're talking about worldwide starvation on a massive scale because of that of that third seal. Then the fourth seal, we saw in verse 7, and we were on verses 5 and 6, excuse me. So let me start there. We had gotten to 3 and 4. So in my notes on verses 5 and 6, let me read it. Then when he opened the third seal, I heard the third living creature say, "Come and see." So I looked, and behold, a black horse, and he who sat on it had a pair of scales in his hand. And I heard a voice in the midst of the four living creatures say, "A quart of wheat for a denarius." Yes, I hadn't covered this yet. I'm a couple of weeks ahead in my study, so I forget where I am with you guys as opposed to where I am studying. So pardon me for that. And I heard a voice in the midst of the four living creatures saying, "A quart of wheat for a denarius and 3 quarts of barley for a denarius, and do not harm the oil or wine." There's a couple of different interpretations on do not harm the oil and wine. I'll get to that in a second. But what is this actually saying? So look at my notes on verses 5 and 6. So it's the last paragraph on the two-sided sheet of paper, or on the last paragraph of the two-sided sheet of paper. Okay? You should have a one-sided sheet of paper that says verses 7 and 8 at the top, and then you should have a two-sided sheet of paper that says Revelation 6, and the first words are five important questions. Okay? Is everybody tracking with me? So that two-sided sheet of paper, we're on the last paragraph. Okay? So riding on the heels of war is always famine. Most people don't know this, but the Spanish flu and the famine that followed World War I in 1919 and 1920 killed more people than World War I. Let me say that again. World War I was horrible. 2 million people died at Verdun. I've been to Verdun in France. And they say that there's probably 1 million unexcavated bodies in the mud, 10, 12, 14 feet down, because the shelling was so great, and then the rains came and the shelling. It said in World War II that when you went to attack through some of those trench lines, that there was a small area where you could walk, and it was mud on each side. And if you fell off into the mud, you would drown in the mud because your pack would carry you to the bottom of the mud pit. So it was horrific carnage in World War I. Not as bad as World War II, but it was horrific carnage. From August of 1914 to November of 1918. Horrific carnage. So 4 years and what, 3 months, 4 months? And yet the famine and the pestilence that followed World War I killed twice as many people as World War I. So famine always follows war because you've torn up the vegetation. You've killed animals. And so you'll go a year or two of severe famine because there's no food. In 1946 and 47, again, most people don't realize the Marshall Plan, the United States, named after General Marshall, to resupply Europe so that Europe wouldn't fall into communist hands, was severe famine. We supplied Europe in 46 and 47 with hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of tons of food because especially the battlefields in Germany and Poland, you know, France, there hadn't been farming, right, because of the war. So this type of famine always follows world war. So what does he say here? A quart of wheat. So if you look at the text, he says a quart of wheat for a denarius. So a quart of wheat is roughly enough food for one person for one day. And a denarius in the time of John, the Roman Empire, was what a common laborer made for a whole day of wages. So whatever an average guy makes today, a blue-collar guy working an 8-10-hour shift, that's a denarius. Okay? So it's for a wealthy, wealthy person, they could get more food because they would make more money. But if you think of average pay for an average worker in America, divide that by how many work days you have, and you're getting a few pieces of bread a day for working all day. In other words, the energy burned to earn the money to buy the bread is about the same or less than what the bread will give you back. This doesn't count a wife working or two or three kids. He's just literally making enough food for himself at a bare minimum survival rate. That's how bad the famine will be across the world. When I was a kid, because of war again, in the Horn of Africa in Ethiopia, you remember the Live Aid concerts that they had for Ethiopia back in the 80s and the 90s? Most people here are old enough to remember that. I mean, you saw these horrible pictures of the distended stomachs of starving little children, which is just horrible. I mean, it just tears your heart out to see those kind of pictures. Understand that in the second half of the tribulation, that will be normal. That will be normal. A family of four, if both parents are working and they're normal, average individuals, and they have a family of four, they will all be living on a half rations of bread. Notice it doesn't say meat. They're just eating bread. Okay? So, my note here is a parent will work all day to feed themselves and nothing left for the family. Notice what God says here. So there's different understandings of what it means. Do not harm the oil or the wine. There's a whole host of different understandings of what that means. I'm going to tell you what I think it means. God cautions people not to waste oil and wine that were used for preparation of food and for purification of water, as everything to survive would be in short supply. Some commentators say, you know, they're in such disaster shape, but they still say we want to get drunk. You know, don't. But that's not how. Largely, olive oil and wine had purposes when John is writing. We think of that with wine today. Wine was largely used medicinally. They understood. Paul says to Timothy, take a little wine for your stomach's sake. They didn't understand how wine was medicinal, but we understand now, right? Alcohol. I mean, if you get, you know, if you have NyQuil, at least when I was a kid, it had 10% alcohol in it, right? So we understand now alcohol can have a medicinal, not an intoxicating purpose. That's how they used it. And so wine was used to mix with water because it purified water. So my takeaway is that water purification clean water is going to be a problem because you have war. Blowing up water treatment plants, destroying how we purify water. One of the things we talk about when you have war is all the waterborne diseases that happen. Remember when Katrina hit? And one of the things they were really concerned about was waterborne diseases because all the water purification plants had got messed up. And remember, if you're old enough to remember, it was trucks and trucks and trucks. A truck pulled outside our church at Tri-City, and it was a Christian organization that was taking relief, and our church bought a semi full of water bottles to send to help for churches, Baptist churches in Katrina's path, to distribute to their neighbors because their biggest need was water that wasn't contaminated. And our church gave thousands of dollars to fill a semi just with water bottles. And our folks loaded them onto the semi, and we had a really good day doing all that and having the water bottles go to Katrina. So the wine purifies water. And then it says oil. So we think of oil. We don't normally think of olive oil as cooking, you know, but that's how they used it. Probably a lot healthier to have olive oil as a cooking oil rather than some of the oils and seed oils we use today, most likely. I think there's a lot of research on that. So maybe more expensive, but it's better for your heart. So I think what John is saying here is God is cautioning them, don't just waste your oil and wine, because water is not going to be healthy for you. And if you just waste the oil, you're not going to be able to cook the small morsels of food that you will have. So care for the oil and the wine. Do not harm the oil and the wine. Fits nicely in the thought of such little food. If there's a famine of food, there's probably also a famine of oil and wine. So you don't just, in actuality, it's not saying, oh, we want the wine to get drunk on. He's saying, no, you need to preserve the wine because you're going to need it for water purification. Don't waste it getting drunk because you're going to need it for water purification. Does that make sense? Okay. And there's disagreement on that. I'm not on the wheat, not so much, but what does it mean? Don't touch the oil and the wine. Some take it, like I said, as look at these horrible people are starving and they still want to get drunk. I think more likely what it is don't waste it because you're going to need it. Okay. Any other comment up to that point? We'll skip over to the next page. There's only one page on that one. Is everybody following me over to the next page? So we're on verses 7 and 8. Let me read that. When he opened the fourth seal, remember there are seven seals here. So when he opens the fourth seal, I heard the voice of the fourth living creature saying, come and see. Remember, it's that same verb. See, behold, look at this. So I looked and behold, he's looking. It's an imperative. It's a command. He's saying to his readers, you need to see this pale horse. That's literally what the Greek is saying. He's saying to his readers, behold, look at this. It's the same verb that's used in Matthew 28, as I've told you before. And lo, I am with you always, even on the end of the age. Lo, look at this. Jesus is saying to his disciples as he's going back to heaven, look at what I'm telling you. I'm with you always, even to the end of the age, no matter who wins the election. So that no matter who wins the election is in parentheses. You know, it's in the Greek. Most of you don't read the Greek. So, but, you know, look at me. I'm with you always, even to the end of the age. What an encouraging thought. Truly, truly, what an encouraging thought. I'm with you to the end of the age. And we have all kind of different ideas out there today about what's right and what's wrong. And one of Marx's ideas is to overload the public with disinformation so then the public doesn't know where truth is. And so then the public will throw up their hands and they'll believe whatever the Marxists tell you to believe. We're experiencing in America. The reason I keep going back to Karl Marx is because the fountainhead of so many of our problems are because our country is largely choosing, as I've explained to you, to follow Karl Marx instead of Charles Spurgeon. They were two leaders with philosophical outlooks. One said man is not made in the image of God, and he's just automaton, he's just a cog, and throw away 20 million of them in Russia, throw away 25 million of them in China, it's okay, because the greater good is the utopia, and nobody is made in the image of God. Charles Spurgeon said everyone is made in the image of God. That's why abortion is murder. That's why changing your gender is flying in the face of God. He chose your gender. He didn't. So Karl Marx says, oh, that's okay, because the disinformation and the lying allows me to come and take over. When man is only responsible to God, or ultimately responsible to God, Karl Marx gets mad because Karl Marx wants to be God. And those who follow him want to be God. Okay? So the reason I keep going back to Marx, some of you think, oh my goodness, I thought we got through that in the Cold War. I mean, I thought we beat communism. Are you kidding me? Communism is alive and well on every single university campus in America. It is absolutely alive and well. And it is because it's man's system of utopia where I get to control and be boss over everybody else. Okay? So when he opens the fourth seal, he looks and notice what he sees. He sees a pale horse, and the name on him who sat on it was death and hell, death and Hades, followed with him. And power was given to them over a fourth of the earth to kill with sword and with hunger and with death and by the beasts of the earth, a fourth. So we are pushing 8 billion in population. Do you understand this seal is open and 2 billion humans are going to die by today's population? Do you remember when I asked you the question 7 weeks ago about how many humans died in the 6 years of the World War II every month? Some of you remember me asking that question? I see a couple of heads, and some of you need coffee. So a couple of you nodding and a couple of you need a coffee. So ironically for historians, Hitler invades Poland on September 1, 1939. And the armistice is signed in Tokyo Bay on September 2, 1945. So it is exactly 6 years. It's exactly 6 years. I've been asking this question. I was just this week with about 50 chaplains and chaplain assistants, had just great times. I was telling the guys a little bit about it in our pastor and deacon prayer meeting this morning, but had a great time of ministering to the chaplains this week in Rhode Island. So I left, I got up at 3 o'clock on Monday morning and flew to Rhode Island. And then on Friday morning, I woke up at Denver time at 1 a.m. to catch my plane to come back on Friday. So anyway, had a great time ministering to a lot of hurting chaplains through dinners, after just sitting in my room or with them in the foyer downstairs counseling. So thank you for letting me do that. Maybe next week when I'm not on tape, I'll tell you about a couple of the conversations, but that are just heartbreaking but encouraging at the same time. So I just traced that bunch. Oh, and I asked them the same thing I asked you guys. So there's 50 military members. And I said, how many humans died every month in World War One or World War II? And to make you guys feel good, they had no clue either. I had somebody that said 10,000. I said, you realize that the Battle of Normandy, that was like 2 days at Normandy. That's not counting what was going on in Italy and Africa and the Russian front and Japan and Philippines and or at Auschwitz. I mean, that was two bad days at Normandy. Was 10,000. So anyway, the right answer is a million a month. 70 million people died in World War II. Russia lost 22 million people by itself. Okay? So when I give you that kind of number, you all blanch. And rightfully so. Do you understand, if my understanding of this text is right, that in 3.5 years, 2 billion people are going to die? It will make World War II look like petty Annieville. We're going to see later that there's an army of 200 million marching out of China, which, when this was written, the entire world's population was less than a billion. But now we know that when you add up all of the Chinese military and its secret service, they have over 100 million in uniform. And that doesn't count India and Vietnam and Japan. The kings of the East come with 200 million people to fight the Antichrist at Armageddon. 200 million. So we used to think that's got to be a fictitious number. People that didn't believe in a literal understanding of Revelation said that number can't pop. 200 million, that's our post-millennial friends that believe that this is in the past, not the future, looked at that number and would used to write 150 years ago. Remember, planet Earth 150 years ago had a billion people, maybe a billion and a half. But through food, greater food, I would say capitalism, and health issues, lower infant deaths, fewer women dying giving birth, all these things, the population of planet Earth has exploded. I mean, when I was a kid, my mom would say, there are starving children in India that would eat that. Do you know that India today exports food? Because of the revolution in how we produce food. So, I just put some of that into perspective for you. I mean, you do the math, 42 months, and divide 42 into 2 billion. Anybody have a calculator, your phone, or your... I don't know that you'll get, Ray, to 2 billion. It may be 200 million might be the highest you can go. I don't know that it'll give you the next digit to 2 billion. They should have done the math on it before I before I came. But you'll... 42 months? $47 million per month. No, of course not. Of course not. We lost 1 million a month in World War II, and that was the most cataclysmic, destructive war in the history of mankind. Nothing even is close. this will be 42 times worse. That's why it's called the Great Tribulation. By God's grace, I trust he's a pre-tribulationalist just like I am. I'm praying that the Lord is a pre-tribulationalist. So, not just because I want to get out of here, but I don't want to live through that. So we see the fourth seal. I'm in my notes. The first seal was the Antichrist coming to conquer, but without any arrows in his bow. He was presenting himself. He presents himself with a victor's crown, not the kingly diadem. I explained that to you, for a crown and as a man of peace. This directly fulfills Daniel 9:27. I've taken you there and shown you that. The second horse was the horse that was red for war. Mars is the red planet, and it was the Roman god of war. March, Mars, was the month that the Romans started their marches toward war as the winter was ending. That's why, as I told you, Caesar was killed on the Ides of March, the 15th of March, because they have a festival starting the 15th of March that goes to the 23rd of March. And Caesar, after having conquered all of Western Europe, was headed to modern-day Iraq and Iran with a massive army, and he was going to conquer Iraq and Iran. And the Senate was terrified that he was going to come back 10 times stronger and 10 times more dictatorial, but the common people loved him. It was the elites that hated Julius Caesar. The common people loved him because he raised up their status, he helped common people. The elites hated him because he was draining from them, and he was lifting up the common people. And so they kill him on the Ides of March. Remember, beware of the Ides of March. Why is that? The god of Mars, that was the war god, and you went to war in March because the weather was turning. And so wherever you were going to go in March to, you know, if you're going to go to Germany, you're going to go to France, it takes you 3 or 4 weeks. So by the time you get to ready to start to go to war, it's May. And you go to war in May, June, July, August, September, and then you go into winter quarters because the snow is coming. Okay, so that's why March is so important in Roman history. Everyone who read Revelation, this book, knew that the war god of Rome was the red planet Mars. They all knew that. Then we saw the black horse for famine, and now we see, I left off the E. Now we say a pale green horse. Think throwing up. When was the last time you really had a stomach virus? You know, you think you're going to, you hope you're going to die, and then you're afraid you won't. You know, I mean, you know how sick you get. My wife really struggled this whole week with really bad stomach virus of some kind. And she was sick all week long. And I said, hey, I've got a horse in my Sunday school lesson for you. So it's a pale green horse. The same word is used of vegetation to give you the idea of green. I mean, how if you were an ancient and you saw somebody that's had a very bad intestinal virus, the blood drains from your face, right? What do you look like? That pale, that green, right? So the same word is used of vegetation. That same color of the horse is used as vegetation in Mark 6:39, Revelation 8:7, and 9:4. It's a sickly color that is often associated with death. What comes with war is plague. And I already mentioned this, but most know that the pandemic that followed World War I, we call it the Spanish flu, it dwarfed COVID's death toll. Dwarfed COVID by multiple times. Killed more people than World War I. The Spanish flu, as it was known, killed millions. This plague will kill, by today's population, over 1.5 billion people. It will make COVID look like nothing. And since we're pushing more toward 2 billion or 8 billion, it's probably, I was being conservative when I said 1.5 billion. Yet as the Lamb opens the seals, every believer knows that God is in control. Who's opening the seals? Who's in control? The Lamb is in control. He's opening the seals. It's not like, oh my goodness, how is, if everything is out of control. This gives us such confidence. So I keep talking about eschatology and end times with us, it needs to give us confidence that God is in control. That's why he tells these seven churches that are just starting the Diocletian persecution in 90. They're just beginning the persecution. There's going to be pastors that are going to die. One church has already had a pastor martyred. He's giving them this future. That's why I so strongly don't believe it's past. What would be the purpose if the post-millennials are right? What would be the purpose of him telling them stuff that already had happened? How does that encourage you? Oh, you can write down what happened.
Yeah.
You're going to take a whole book and at the end of it say, don't take a word away or don't add a word. Or all the curses are added to you. Why would you write about history that was 25 years old and then say, don't take anything away or add anything? What's the point of that? The point for a dispensationalist is that this means God is in control. He has the future. And it may be uncomfortable and it may be hurtful and there may be tears and it may be sorrow. And we know we're going to see that believers are under the altar crying out, how long, O Lord? And the Antichrist is going to kill millions of believers during that time. But God is in control. God is not, as I often say, he's not chain smoking. Oh my goodness. Gabriel, get over here. I don't know what's going on. Michael, get over here. Oh, archangels, we need to figure out, let's get in a group huddle and figure out how can we solve this problem on planet Earth. That's not what God's going through. And that's the whole point of why he gives us this. The Lamb opens the seals, and every believer knows that God is in control because he's opening the seals. Okay, verses 9 to 11, let's start there. And we won't finish that section by any stretch of the imagination, but we'll stick our toe in the water here for a couple of minutes. When he opened the fifth seal, I saw under the altar, I was giving you the trailer, and now I'm going to give you the movie. I saw under the altar the souls of those who had been slain for the word of God and for the testimony. Remember, that word testimony is the word martyrios in the Greek language. We get our word martyr from it. We get our word martyr from it. So he says he saw the souls and for the word of God and the testimony which they held, and they cried with a loud voice, saying, how long, O Lord, holy and true, until you judge and avenge our blood on those who dwell on the earth? Then a white robe was given to each of them, and it was said to them that they should rest a little while longer until both the number of their fellow servants and their brethren who would be killed as they were was completed. Once again, God's in control. He's like, let's look at the notes, but I just want you to get that God is not out of control, and he's not unaware, and he's not unsympathetic with his witnesses who are giving their life for him. He's very aware. So let's go to my notes, and it looks like I have 3 minutes. So now we see the fifth seal being opened. In the Old Testament, when the priest presented the animal sacrifice, the animal's blood was poured out at the base of the brazen altar. So I'm not talking about Yom Kippur, when they would go into the high priest once a year went into the Holy of Holies. That's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about the morning and the evening sacrifices that happened every single day. Okay? So when the priest presented the animal sacrifice, the animal's blood was poured out, get it, at the base of the brazen altar. You can go back to Leviticus 4:7, verse 18, verse 25, verse 30. The blood is poured out at the base of the altar. Where are these souls? Where? They're at the base of the altar. Isn't that interesting? They're at the base of the altar. They are the sacrifices. They have sacrificed themselves. I say, and I am not a big fan of pain. I tell my wife all the time that man colds, women will never understand them. Man colds are just horrible. There's something similar to giving birth. I mean, they are just horrific events that no woman will ever grasp the significance of a man cold. Oh, my wife is probably working in the kitchen. I hope she does that. And that'll all stay between us, right? What goes to Sunday school, what goes to Sunday school stays in Sunday school. We don't share that with Elma. With that, yeah. So I'm not a fan of pain. Okay. I'm not a fan of pain. But we live in a culture in which even our Christian, the slightest little problem, and we fall into a pile of ooze, metaphorically, complaining, griping. These are martyrs at the base of the altar, just like, and it's not coincidental that in the vision that everybody would understand because they did this sacrifice. That the souls are at the base of the altar where the sacrifices were. The martyrs of the church are under the altar in heaven. I'm back in my notes, third line. As it were, they sacrificed their lives for Christ, just as the animals had been sacrificed in the Old Testament. The word testimony is literally the word martyr. It means witness. It meant witness. But because so many Christians were killed by the Romans during the next 300 years, the word slowly went behind the simple meaning of witness to the one who gives up their life. Like we would talk about, he was a martyr for his cause, right? The word martyr meant, in Roman times, a witness on an illegal. Like, you're on the stand and you say, yeah, I'll tell the truth, and you're a martyr. We would say, well, that's not the definition of a martyr. Yes. That was their definition of a witness, martyr, but because so many Christians were killed and witnessed their truth of their belief with their death, the word martyrios went away from being what we think of as a witness on a witness stand to a word that means giving up one's life. It added another meaning. Many millions will accept Jesus as the Messiah during these 7 years. Even though the Antichrist will deceive many, many millions will accept Christ. However, many, if not most, of these believers will seal their faith with their blood. The satanic forces of the tribulation do not accept these heroes' witness because they love the dark and not the light. They will hate them as all demonically possessed or satanically influenced people today and in the past have always hated God's children. The souls under the altar awaiting the second resurrection, found in Revelation 24, want to know how much longer it must be before the wicked are judged. Even in their prayers, God reminds them that their death and the deaths of others are a sovereign appointment. Others will join them in heaven for their testimony, but it is all in God's plan. God assures them with their white robes that they are purified from sin, its presence, and its power. Won't that be a wonderful day for all of us? These are not spirits without substance, for no spirit could wear a robe. I want to stop and so we have a body in heaven. They have a robe. When we are in heaven, we will have a body and will be clothed as these faithful saints are clothed. Their prayer here is not a prayer of revenge, as both Christ and Stephen asked for forgiveness on those who murdered them, but rather a protest against all that is sinful, unholy, dishonoring to God, and destructive to his plan and purpose. These souls want God's glory to inhabit the universe, undeterred by evil men. Oh, I'm 3 minutes over. Comment or question? Yeah, go ahead, Chris. So the good answer to that is found in 1 John. John says many antichrists are gone out into the world. There are many little a antichrists all over America today. Some have crosses on the buildings they lead people in worship in. I was just watching one the other day in a video, and she was going on as the pastor of her church about how much she rejoiced in her 3 abortions. And she is the pastor of that church. No. but it could have been. So let me give you another one. I was just in Rhode Island, and I took Thursday afternoon and I went and visited the First Baptist Church in America, founded by Roger Williams. It's a historical site. And the Second Baptist Church, founded by John Clark in Newport. I saw them both on Thursday afternoon and Thursday evening. The Roger Williams Church, his first church that he built in 1638 after he got kicked out of Massachusetts because he believed in baptism by believers, baptism, and separation of church and state, and the Puritans didn't, so they kicked him out. He bought the land from the Native Americans and had a great relationship with them. He even mediated different wars, and he spoke both the major languages of the Native Americans there in Rhode Island. In 1775, the building I was in, the Providence had 4,000 people in 1775. They finished the building in May of 1775, so a year and 2 months before the signing of the Declaration of Independence. This building is that old. It seats 1,200 people. You walk down two blocks, and that's where his original meeting house was. And that's a historical site. Having said all that, I just kind of knocked on the door. Could I get in? And they were having a rummage sale on the inside. And the female pastor gave me a guided tour. And I would be shocked if she was heterosexual. This is the First Baptist Church in America. She said they have about 100 people, 80 to 100 people in their congregation. It seats 1,200. It's a beautiful church, an unbelievable church. The pillars that they built in 1775, each pillar comes from one whole oak tree. They have pillars that supports the whole. It's a gorgeous church. I can show you the pictures of it. But my point is, now I'm really over. It's all Chris's fault. My point is that many antichrists go out of the world. Those are little A's. In other words, they are deceivers. They sound good. They're deceivers. There will be one capital A antichrist, and that's who this is. That's the man on the white horse that doesn't have arrows, and he makes a covenant with Israel, and all the Israelis and the Arabs lay down all their weapons, and the peace breaks out all over the earth in those first 3.5 years. That's the capital A antichrist that is yet to be revealed. Does that make sense?